take a second to generate a virtuous motivation, a constructive motivation for just listening to the talk and meditating together. So just think, just as ourselves want happiness and want to avoid suffering, so every other being in this room, in Santa Cruz, in California, in the United States, the entire world, universe, all living beings want happiness. So whatever goodness, I guess you could say virtue, that we're gathering in this room tonight through listening, thinking about the Dharma together, and also practicing, may become a cause for our own enlightenment, so we may benefit others. So just generate that really gently in your heart. I'm just kind of curious. I recognize some of you from the day longs where I've been here, but a lot of you I don't recognize. Welcome. I'm just curious of how many are sort of familiar with Buddhist practice or philosophy? Yeah, just in general. Yeah, how many are familiar with Tibetan Buddhist philosophy? Okay. So most of you have some connection. It's good. Tonight's topic is it's not like a beginner's topic. So if this is your first time sort of, and you came to learn meditation or something, we're definitely approaching like more the philosophy side of meditation tonight, but we'll also practice, yeah? So there'll be some integration as well. But I just want to give you that fair warning that the talk is a little bit, not the easiest thing to understand right away. So just be patient and don't throw tomatoes, please. But again, just to reinforce, definitely the idea is that how to integrate it, yeah? So this isn't necessarily a philosophy class. It's just there's some terminology, there's some concepts that we have to talk about in order to actually be able to practice. Does that make sense? Yeah? And then hopefully we'll have another session of meditation and I'll guide it a little bit. Yeah? So first here, I just want to mention how we can fully engage the Dharma here. Yeah. So we have these three aspects, yeah, of listening, yeah, reflecting, and then meditation. So here we're actually going to combine all three tonight. Normally people would come to a teaching, listen, maybe reflect a little bit, but go home and then reflect and meditate more. So if these, if the talk tonight, if it inspires you, I guess there's another way to say it, please go home and put it into practice and meditate and reflect on it more. The reason we have these three in Buddhism is in order to actually reflect on something and then meditate, the Buddha taught all kinds of Dharma teachings that can then be put into practice. If we don't have some kind of understanding first, there's nothing, no way to meditate, yeah? Even if it's quite a simple meditation where we're just using our breath, we have to have been, we had to have heard that first, yeah? Correct? Yeah? So I just want to emphasize that if it gets kind of too heady for you, the whole point is to then be able to put it into practice, yeah? So here tonight, we call it real but not true. So this phrase, real but not true, it's actually a phrase that my teacher, Sonia Rinpoche, kind of came up with, yeah? And it really, really reflects, in a very pithy saying, what the middle way teachings are within Tibetan Buddhism. Is anyone familiar with the middle way teachings? Yeah? A couple people, okay. Basically, it's Buddhist Maya philosophy, yeah? It doesn't matter if you're not familiar, it's just wondering. So within the Buddhist middle way, and just when we're talking about the nature of reality itself from a Buddhist perspective, yeah, or trying to put this into our practice, into our meditation, we have these aspects of reference point. So I really want to emphasize tonight, whenever I'm bringing up sort of ideas around when the Buddha taught specifically emptiness, yeah, we're talking about reference point. What's our reference point in relation to our own minds, our own bodies, other phenomena, be they people, or the room, all kinds of things like that, yeah? So if we bring it back to that level, I think it uncomplicates a lot of things. When you just think, what is my experience in reference to, yeah? How am I actually experiencing myself and other phenomena? I think most of you are familiar with the Four Noble Truths, yeah? More or less, yeah? So, yeah, you guys, many people teach it here, yeah? Yeah. So I kind of want to start off by this first thing the Buddha said, yeah? After he attained enlightenment or awakening. The Buddha said, you know, no dukkha, yeah? No suffering. That was the first words out of the Buddha's mouth when he actually taught the Dharma. And within this phrase, no suffering, it's actually an extremely loaded thing. I mean, believe it or not. I mean, there's more grosser aspects to it, and then it gets subtler and subtler and subtler. And of course, in the Tibetan Buddhist lineage, we have, you know, Mahayana teachings and also Vajrayana teachings. So you could take this phrase, no suffering, and bring it into all of those vehicles, including from the Shravakya, the Theravada, on through. So it has incredible depth to this phrase, no suffering. Yeah? I like to say no suffering, I guess you could say the truth of suffering, but when you say no suffering, it's sort of like the Buddha's really asking us, please investigate this. You see? Like, oh, here's the truth of, you know, I know the truth of suffering, I'm going to, you know, tell. He's not saying that, you know. Just really no suffering. Please investigate what is suffering. Or in one way, we can translate it as dissatisfaction. That's another way. Some teachers translate it as that. And it's a nice way. It sort of doesn't encompass everything, but it is a kind of sort of getting to the more subtler aspects of it, this dissatisfaction, yeah? So, first, of course, most of us know when the Buddha said no suffering, yeah? What he, of course, meant was birth, old age, sickness, and death, yeah? These four rivers, they're common. And when he says no dukkha or no dissatisfaction, know that when you're born, right there is the cause for sickness, it's the cause for death, yeah? Within the birth itself. So that's one aspect, yeah? But, excuse me, but really what the Buddha was referring to when we bring it into a more loaded term or a more loaded teaching, he was referring to a much, much deeper aspect of this suffering, yeah? Just on another, it's not gross, I would say, but on a more outward level, of course, the Buddha was also referring to karma and afflictive emotions, that due to our afflictive emotions, be it anger, ignorance, excessive desire, we then create karma that ripens, yeah, into either suffering or happiness, or it can be neutral karma too. But I'm not going into that so much. I'm just sort of, some of you know this, these are just general Buddhist teachings, yeah? But more or less, when you hear the term no suffering, you often get teachings like that, yeah? Which is true. These are the more sort of outward ways. But what I really want to discuss tonight is, What was the Buddha really, on a subtle level, how do we know suffering? Meaning, what creates the cause for suffering, yeah? So, what I want to explore is an aspect of this term, this teaching on the First Noble Truth, of really referring to this constant, this greater or deeper suffering of constantly taking birth, moment by moment. So, this is, I think, something pretty unique to Buddhism, where there's actually this idea or presentation of reality where it's not just a big birth when we just are born into a body. Actually, we're taking birth in each moment. Yeah? So it's I'm being kind of vague right now, but I just want to put that out there. It's like a type of birth happening in each moment. Yeah? Again, so you can unpack this to say sort of, in a way, we often walk through our day, we talk with others, we have all kinds of experiences, again, with a reference point of I'm here and I'm experiencing all of this out there, yeah? We point or say, usually when we say I or me, we kind of point here. I do that. Does anybody else do that? We point at our body, at our aggregate of form, yeah? And we say, oh, I or me, yeah? And we say, and we kind of assume, just on a more intellectual level, we assume when we do that, that there's something there, right? that there's something sort of, I am something. Yes? So there's always this kind of reference point. So I want you to just ask yourself, and we can sit for a second, how are you appearing in this very moment to yourself? Like if you ask yourself, okay, where am I? Who am I? Like how does it appear to you? It can be a lot of different things. There's no right answer. It's just sort of, just reflect on that for a second. Again, there's nothing, there's no right answer. Just the first thing that comes to mind, when you think of me or I, what pops up? Anybody want to respond? Yeah.
Thoughts, my mind.
That's you. You're, that's kind of your experience of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Good one. Can be anything.
Feeling.
Feeling. Like a sensation or more like emotion feeling?
Just a feeling of everything.
Okay. Good. Yeah. We'll come back to yours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My name comes up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my experience at the moment when you asked me was feeling my body in this position and remembering a photograph of someone, and the title of the photograph was Listening to the Dharma.
Mm.
Yeah. My feeling started with a light, uh-huh. And then it was just fell over the rest.
Okay. Anyway, this side of the room is very, very good. You guys are a little slower. No offense. Could mean you're really thinking about it. Anybody? Yeah?
I had an image of my body position.
Yeah. I do that too.
Yeah.
So form.
Mm-hmm. Form.
Yeah.
I just sort of shifting impressions over time of who I've experienced or thought myself to be.
So it shifted.
Well, my view of myself has shifted, so it's just kind of...
Just you mean in the last few moments?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and you noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Have you been meditating a long time? That's pretty good. Yeah.
I felt like I was... I'm my relationships.
Mm. Yeah. Good. Those are all really... Yeah, really good. So... If we did this investigation, we continued it, yeah, let's say for half an hour or an hour, you'd see, like this woman's experience, it often changes, and the reference point will sort of change. And if we dig... Now, normally, we're not digging deeper, you know, just on a normal level. We're sort of assuming, oh, yeah, I'm here. There's something here that is me, right? And we sort of assume that, whether it's form or feeling... Or thought, or we're our thoughts, or we're our in relationship, right? But what I'm trying to imprint is often if you dig deeper, these are kind of vague, no? I mean, I know when I work with this meditation, it's a little bit like when you start to dig deeper, you see, wow, I'm having a lot of assumption of who I am actually based off of one aspect of me. Does that make sense? Is this getting too complicated now? Okay. So. Very simply, like without going into a lot of crazy Buddhist philosophy, yeah, this is the root of suffering, yeah? So if we're very simply saying it, of course, like that's kind of simplifying it a little too much, but this aspect of when we impute something onto our aggregates and then we label I, and then we have some kind of relationship of believing that, this is what the Buddha taught when he said no suffering. This is the root of all other suffering or all other dukkha. Yeah. So it's in one way it's quite simple, and I'm kind of giving you the answer now, but it's okay because you have to practice it, so it obviously won't come deeply until you practice it. But the whole point is I just want to show you how if we go into some more philosophy, it doesn't have to get so complicated. This is the more, it's really that simple. So then the Buddha had this famous, where there's this famous quote, yeah, from the Dhammapada. We are what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts, and then with our thoughts we make the world, yeah. So this is actually extremely profound teaching. And with our thoughts, we make the world. So again, why do we have this experience? So when I asked you to investigate, and then, you know, we had all kinds of different experiences, and I'm sure they would change, you know, maybe you suddenly, you kind of impute with your thoughts, there's something there, or form, you can go to form, it can switch back into feelings, into relationship with outer things. When you break them down, really what we're talking about is habits, yeah? So in a way, when the Buddha says, with our thoughts we make the world, you could also say, with our habits we make the world, yeah? So then how do we work with these habits? This is the whole key, yeah? It's actually, it can be quite shifting if you work with this practice a lot, and it can be kind of life-changing if you work. And just observe. We're going to actually practice that. Just observing that kind of vague sense of an I, and just being with that. We're going to practice this later. But it's also helpful to apply a little bit of investigation. So we're kind of going to alternate tonight some, I'd say, a reflection or investigation or logic, you could say, combined with some more resting practice, where we're just actually just resting in that experience of that, or that vague notion. So then through fixating on our experience, you could say we make our world. Yeah? It's another way to say that. Again, going back to this aspect of reference point. So there's so many interesting things that happen throughout our lives. I mean, just in a day, I mean, we can come up with so many, but I'll give you an example where, you know, we get so stuck in our habits. I'm in the kitchen where I live, and often, you know, I'm used to picking certain knives up or certain, you know, cookingware, things like that to make lunch or dinner or whatever. And for the longest time, I just go to certain drawers and I go to certain things and I pull them down. And I don't know, I was in retreat last winter and I had this experience where I found a whole new drawer. Like, has that ever happened to you? I literally found a whole new drawer. And I was like, wow, there's a drawer here. And I could have put stuff in here, but instead I shoved it all into one drawer so it's totally packed. Because that was my reference point at that time. So actually it sounds kind of stupid, but it's not. If you really, really look at this, you can see we drive to work a certain way. Yeah. Whether, you know, and then we get stuck in that pattern. Maybe that way was really, there was less traffic a year ago, but now there's more, but we just keep doing the same habit. Yeah. And similarly with positive habits. We also have positive habits that benefit us. But either way, again, when we say with our thoughts we make the world, we could also say with our habits we make the world. Yeah. So I wanted to emphasize sort of when Buddhist yogis, you know, who really take these practices to their pinnacle, you know, either high realization, becoming an arhat, or a Buddha, an enlightened being, you can see how they slowly eroded, the habits as a reference point. So there's no problem, actually. The Buddha wasn't saying, I should say this because it's really key. The Buddha wasn't saying then get rid of your habits. Mm-hmm. That's not what the Buddha was saying. Yeah, he was saying, understand the reference point in relation to those habits and how you're actually relating to them. That's more the key here, yeah? So when you're able to do that and bring it to its full extent, when you're able to actually see through the habits, and you can still engage in the habit, but I don't know if it's quite a habit anymore. It's like they have this rope. They use this example a lot in Tibetan Buddhism. There's a certain type of rope in India. I've never, ever seen it. Maybe there's I know at least one person from India here. Maybe you can tell me this. It's a rope where you burn the rope and then it keeps its shape, yeah? But it's not a rope. It can't actually function. But it has the kind of shape of a rope, yeah? Is there something like that?
It's kind of wound up together, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So they use this as an example for when we practice this and the practices come to their fruition, where we actually come into a direct experience. Everything can still be there. We're not denying anything. It's just like this rope where everything's burned. So the shape of the rope is kind of the same, but it doesn't function as a rope anymore. Therefore, we've eradicated suffering. Yeah. So I'm just kind of pointing that out. But you have these wonderful stories. One of my favorites, just to talk about habits and how habits sort of make our world. And then transform those habits, I guess you could say is one way, they actually can turn into something miraculous. From our perspective, it would be a miracle, or it would be a... like a fable, or like a, what do you call it, a, what do you call it, like a fantasy story or something like that. So there's this great Indian pandita called Chandrakirti. Yeah? So Chandrakirti, there's these great scholar yogis who existed throughout the history of Nalanda Monastery, yeah, which is a huge monastic complex for Buddhists and monastics in India. And you can still go there if you're ever in India. It's near Vulture's Peak, which is where the Heart Sutra was taught, but near there is Nalanda, and it's just massive, and it's an archaeology site, so they're unearthing it. So Chandrakirti lived there, and he was a famous scholar and also practitioner and yogi. And, of course, Chandrakirti was a realized being. You know, he was an arahant. He had sort of conquered, more or less, he had gone beyond suffering. So Chandrakirti, there was a famine kind of happening. Not quite a famine, but there was a shortage of food in the monastery at that time. So they didn't have dairy or any kind of, you know, grains, and they were really short on it. So Chandrakirti, he went to it. There was a painting of a cow on a wall, or some kind of fresco or something, and he actually milked the painting of the cow, and then fed the whole monastery, you know, with his milk, right? You know, supposedly, yeah? We don't know, we weren't there. So, you know, when I first heard this story, I thought, oh, like, wow, he's like, that's so like a city. We call that cities in Buddhism, right? It's a magical power, kind of, right? But the more I investigate this, and actually I've heard some other teachings on it, it's not that he did it out of some kind of magical power. It was because he had no habit to think of a normal cow and a painting of a cow as different. So actually he was able to milk the painting. You see? So I just want to... This sounds kind of strange, and it's pretty strange, actually, from our Western scientific point of view. But I just want to point it out as a possibility. Yeah. Just leave it there if it doesn't resonate so much. But really I'm trying to make a point, which is, when we're talking about habits, we assume this floor, we can stand on this floor, you know? We assume that we're going to drive home and similar things are going to happen. But are they really similar? Are they really the same? Are we just like labeling that they're similar? Do you see what I'm saying? Often we're stuck in sort of a relate, you know, be it a dialogue with someone that's constructive or not constructive. We can get stuck in sort of a habit because we're perceiving that situation as permanent. You see, we're perceiving it as something that's not changing. So when you're able to really bring this into your practice and slowly break down the habits and be open to, not only open to change, but your whole reference point is in reference to change. You see, or in reference to this open kind of open dimensional quality. A lot of the times, and it's mostly I'm talking about myself here. It's so easy to be sort of one-dimensional, yeah? That's often how we live our lives. What the Buddha was asking is, no suffering, know how to be open-dimensional. There's no reference point, yeah? Also, there's another story I really like. Have anybody heard of Milarepa?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Okay, yeah, he's pretty famous. Maybe more famous than Chandrakirti. You don't really hear of Chandrakirti until you study Madhyamika, like the middle way teachings in Buddhism. But anyways, Chandrakirti at one time was really famous. I'm just trying to back him up. You know? Anyways. Anyways, Milarepa, for those of you who don't know, he was a famous Tibetan yogi. He's probably one of the most famous for his life story, where he went from being a murderer to being actually an enlightened being within that same lifetime. Yeah. So, Milarepa, he was with... This is at the time when he already reached accomplishment, or we could say he reached enlightenment or Buddhahood. Yeah. It's later in his life, and he had students, and one of his students was... I believe this story is with Rachumpa. One of his students was Rachumpa. And so he was out with Rachumpa one day walking in a field or on a mountain, and it started to just pour. And of course, Milarepa, from his side, he doesn't care if it's raining, if it's sunning, if there's sun, if there's snow, whatever. He doesn't have that kind of reference point anymore to have the suffering from that object. Yeah. But to prove a point to Rachumpa, he said, "Oh, it's raining. We got to take cover now." But they were in a huge field, so there was nowhere to actually take cover. All that was there was, they have yaks in Tibet, right? Has anybody seen these big yaks? And yaks can have horns, big horns. So there was a yak horn just on the ground. So then the story goes that Milarepa took refuge in the yak horn without making the yak horn any bigger or making his body any smaller. Yeah? So this sort of confounded, for years this has confounded me, you know. I think it's still, obviously on a direct level, it confounds me, you know. It's meant to confound, you see. But again, we're talking about reference points here. Milarepa, at that point in his realization of the nature of reality, he didn't have a reference point of the yak horn being too small to fit, or his body being too big. So he was able to fit it, you see. But we're not talking just the thought. We're not talking just an intellectual knowledge of thinking, oh, it's like that. Because if we do that, we probably won't fit. you could try it. Please email me, you know, if you want to get in there, you know, and I will prostrate to you. I will come to your house and prostrate to you and ask you for teachings. You know? But anyways, so this came out of his realization, his direct experience of the nature of reality. Sometimes we also call this shunyata or tungpani in Tibetan. Or they use this word emptiness, but I'm sticking away from this term because it's a loaded term, and it doesn't just for those of you hearing for the first time, it doesn't mean a nothingness. Yeah, we're talking about something independent. That's why things can function, but they don't exist in this concrete way. Why? Because at the end of the day, there is no reference point. So you could almost say like samsara is a reference point. Most of you know samsara, yeah. Samsara is this cycle of suffering, yeah? Going from birth to birth, yeah? But also, it's related to our thought processes, it's everything, yeah? So, you could say that. So then, mostly due to our habit of perceiving phenomena as solid and unchanging, and sort of, and again, when I say we're perceiving, maybe some of you are like, well, I don't perceive that way, you know? And actually, that's fine, you can tell me that. I actually invite you to investigate that. But what we're actually saying is, it's not a thought process sometimes, it's a deep, deep, deep subconscious, just right away that happens, yeah? Like, if someone comes at you with fire, you go like this, right?
It's a reflex.
It's like a reflex, but there's also a instinct. Yeah, it's almost like it's a ingrained instinct. So this is what we call the deepest kind of maripa, or not knowing, or ignorance within Buddhism, yeah? Which is just that the reaction is so habitual. So again, when we say habit in Buddhism, we're referring to habits of this life, like me with the drawer. We're referring to that. But actually, it's more referring to these habitual patterns that have gone on from life to life. So they become quite ingrained, right? You can imagine. So then, through many different means, we really have to break these down. Any kind of practice we do, working with either shamatha practice or working with the practice we're going to do a type of vipassana practice tonight, yeah, working with that, or working with philosophy or logic. If we work with these things in the correct way, really the result is slowly it sheds away layers. Yeah, it's not like most of us are not going to go from like zero to five million and 5 miles per hour in just one moment. It's a very gradual shedding, yeah? Shedding of this reference point, okay? So, how do we go about this sort of a shedding, yeah? This gradual shedding? How do we actually accomplish this? So we need a path, yeah? And by path, when we say path in Buddhism, we're just talking about more or less methods. I mean, the path isn't just methods, but the path is full of all kinds of methods. Shamatha, yeah? Vajrayana, lots of visualizations, deities, all these kinds of things, yeah? Studying, contemplating on emptiness, practicing the paramitas, yeah? These are all different methods. And again, this is, I think, something was really key for me because, I don't know, has anybody been a Buddhist more than 20 years? I've been practicing more than 20 years. Couple years? 23? Oh, you're 23. 23 years. Not just yet. So, anyways, my point is, when you practice for quite a few years and your path deepens, you come to a point where you really start to question, you know, what's actually going on here? You know, maybe that you figured that out earlier, but I personally came to a point, I haven't been practicing 20 years, but around 14 years, I came to a point where you just hit a wall, and then you realize, wow, there's a lot of things I'm just accepting dogmatically, You know, or I'm accepting that someone said it, yeah? So I really investigated. Okay, I really wanted to investigate. Okay, what's the path? What are we talking about when we're talking about a method within Buddhism? Or what are we trying to do? What are we trying to accomplish here? You know, am I just trying to do a bunch of things and become a better person, you know, or something like that? And actually, that's nice. Like, to become a better person is a nice goal. But in Buddhism, it's actually not the goal. We're going beyond even being a person. You see what I'm saying? Into something that goes beyond suffering in order to actually benefit others. So then, within the corpus of the Dharma, we have the Buddha taught, you know, they say 84,000 teachings. Why 84,000? Well, supposedly there's 84,000 delusions. I haven't been able to find them all. But I guess, you know, if you break them down into subtler categories and they can turn into 84,000. There's also 84, there's a lot of, what do you call it? We all have similarities as humans, but we can also be very different, and different things are going to work for us, you see? So there's 84,000 teachings. And again, when I was investigating this, I thought, well, what do these have in common? And then when you really check whether you're meditating on a loving kindness, on metta, or compassion, or when you're meditating on emptiness, or when you're doing a day yoga practice, whatever the practice is, really, this is the whole path of that practice is to slowly shed this reference point. So I just keep emphasizing this over and over, because it's actually, if you're able to figure this out and apply it, things become much, there's much less like static around. Does that make sense? Because especially Tibetan Buddhism, I like to come here and make fun of Tibetan Buddhism. Because I know some of you are Theravada, yeah, or insight practitioners, so I like to make fun. You know, there's a lot of static going on in Tibetan Buddhism. Not that it's not useful, it's useful. But when we first approach it, it could seem like it's very easy to get stuck in a practice. You see what I'm saying? As opposed to a path. Mm-hmm. And what's a path? Again, a path is a method. Within the Buddha Dharma, a path is a method that should really erode our reference point. And if that's not happening, and of course, that's on one level. The other level is it should grow our loving kindness and compassion towards others. That's this other side. But again, if you really look, the more loving you become towards others, the more your reference point sheds, correct? Yeah? Okay. So again, it's a skillful means. So I just want to point that out. So then, So then, mostly tonight we're talking about this aspect of wisdom, yeah, or wisdom within Buddhism. So, what is wisdom within Buddhism? We're talking about an understanding, and then eventually a direct experience of the nature of reality. So, whenever we say wisdom, that's what it's referring to. Now, one way, there's many, many different ways to present sort of Buddhist wisdom, yeah? What I'd like to talk about now is illusion. So again, we've kind of been talking about illusion, where when I asked you guys to really try to search for or find where you're feeling a sense of I or a sense of me, if you investigate that more, you'll see it's quite vague. So it's like an illusion, yeah? So I don't know, does anyone have, how do you guys normally think of the term illusion? I'm just curious. You can throw it in, there's no, could be a dictionary definition.
Ephemeral?
Yes. Yeah.
Not what it seems.
Not what it seems. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Made up.
Made up. Seems
story.
Real. Story. Yeah. Yeah, good. So, in one way, what we can say, interpretation, you know, again, that's going back to reference point, but from a Buddhist perspective, when we say an illusion, what we're talking about is something that's not really, it's not really there, but then we continue to perceive it, yeah? So it's an illusion, something that's not there, but we continue to perceive it. So there's no true nature, but we continue to have experience. So I just want to emphasize that. When we use this word true, I'm going to define true in a second, what does it mean when it says true, yeah? But there's no true nature, but then we have experience, yeah? So whenever I'm talking about the nature of reality or emptiness tonight, Buddhism is never actually, there's no denying that we have experience. There's no need to deny that. That wouldn't help anyone. Like, for instance, it's fine to drink orange juice and to, like, enjoy orange juice. Buddhism doesn't deny that there's orange juice. It's just denying the label orange juice. You know, that there's something that permanently, concretely exists as orange juice. You can't find that, actually, if you look for it. But we can enjoy the orange juice. Yeah, that's kind of a, it's kind of a magical thing, actually, when you think about it. So, one kind of illusion we have is this illusion of permanence. Yeah? So, everything is actually in the nature of change. Everything is changing all the time. There's something like, we change all our cells in 7 days and the whole body's out, something like that?
7 years.
7 years. Oh, 7 days would be a lot.
That'd be cool.
Okay. Someone told me the other night, so I was trying to remember. What, that'd be cool, yeah. We'd probably live a lot longer. So 7 years, yeah. Every 7 years. So after 7 years, we might still have this reference point of, I'm me, yeah, I'm Namsel, and I'm this kind of way, and I have these kinds of relationships and these kinds of personality traits and things like that. But actually, I'm not even the same at all. Like, there's nothing that's the same about me from 7 years ago. I mean, literally on a cellular level. I mean, I guess there's things that are the same, but they change more or less. Yeah. So again, we could prove this phenomena do not have any absolute or unbreakable, unchangeable characteristics. So then why do we perceive in that way? So we have to continually ask ourselves whether we are perceiving our experience as this kind of constantly ever unfolding, changeable experience, or are we fixated onto experience? Yeah? So again, one way to talk about this is a reference point, but there's also, in one way, when you drop the reference point, it also drops the fixation, you see? So again, when we're talking about emptiness, we're not talking about, there's no problem with something arising. For instance, if we get angry, or if we get whatever happens, there's no problem with that. The problem is the fixation. Yeah? And there's this famous quote Talopa told. Talopa is another great Indian Mahasiddha. Yeah, I was telling at dinner. I was telling a story. You know, he probably looked like sadhus do now when you go to India. Have you ever seen a sadhu where they're completely naked, or they just have a cloth here? And I was in Nepal, and I saw one sadhu, and you know, he had like big dreads, like up here and a beard. I thought, wow, this is what Talopa probably looked like. And he was a great Mahasiddha. Like, again, Talopa, if you read his life story, or you read Naropa, who's his main disciple, if you read how they interacted, it completely breaks concepts. You know, when Naropa, this isn't my point, but I'm telling the story. When Naropa went to try to find Talopa. Naropa was a monk in Nalanda Monastery, and then at some point he was needed to study the more esoteric teachings. He had sort of taken the other teachings as far as he could, and he needed esoteric, more Vajrayana or Tantric Buddhism. So he went to go find Talopa. And when he found Talopa, he finally found him after a long journey. You know, he asked someone in the village, oh, I heard, is Talopa here? And they said, there's a great yogi named Talopa. And the one said, oh, I don't know about a great yogi, but there's a homeless guy down by the river, you know, who lives down there. So he said, oh, that's got to be Talopa, you know. So when he went down to the river, he actually saw Talopa had a pan, and he was catching fish in the river, frying them alive, and then he was snapping his fingers, and they would come back alive and jump back in the river. So again, this is like, some of you might think, that's not Buddhist, you know. How could you kill something? He wasn't actually killing them, right? This is, again, going beyond concept. There was an aspect where he was, of course, they were in the pan and they were frying, but when he snapped his fingers, they came back alive and jumped in. So again, this was a teaching for Naropa. Yeah? So great yogis like that will do things like that, that are just beyond our concept. But that wasn't my point. My point was that he has this phrase he told Naropa, because we were talking about fixation, right? He said, Naropa, it's not appearances. It's not appearances or phenomena that bind you. It's fixating or grasping onto those appearances that bind you. So cut grasping, Naropa. You know, this is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful teaching for us. It really shows you, okay, what's our aim? What are we trying to do within the Buddha Dharma? Yeah? So again, we can talk about like an illusion, yeah, something that's not really there. But our reference point, for the most part, what Buddha was saying is know that reference point. Know that reference point is suffering. Why is it suffering? It's not because we're bad or something. It's just that we have this habit to fixate on the reference point, yeah? And then not actually view it as illusion. So within Buddha Dharma, we're constantly bringing about this aspect of this illusory experience. But please, Don't run with your illusory body in front of an illusory car, because you will illusory die. So don't do that. And then say, Nam Sala said it. Don't do that. We're not saying that. Why can that happen too? Because of emptiness, things can also function. There's dependent arising. Things, independence on each other, have causes and conditions. That's why we have karma and cause and effect. Yeah. So it's very tricky to understand this. There, at one point, Buddhism is saying, it's totally an illusion, but then at the other side, because of that illusion, things function. You see? So you're not denying, and you're not accepting. That's what's so confounding about this. So I hope it's not too complicated. I was a little bit leery presenting this tonight, but it's okay. It's too late now. Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about, one of the last things, is another way of talking about this is phenomena, ourselves, our reference point. By phenomena, I should be clear, when we say, within the middleweight teachings, when we say phenomena in Buddhism, we're not just talking about outer things, so we're actually talking about everything. So phenomena includes our bodies, our feelings, our emotions, our thoughts, our mind even, like at its subtle level, which is just clear and knowing. Phenomena include that. It also includes this room. It includes all of you. So phenomena just means everything. More like anything that's not emptiness is phenomena. Yeah? So I just want to make that clear. So another way to talk about illusion or this aspect of getting away from this fixation of reference point, yeah, fixating on an I or me or a reference point, is this idea of being dreamlike. So just as things are illusion-like, you could also say things are dream-like, yeah? So when we practice the path of Buddha Dharma, we're trying to wake up from this dream. And I just want to emphasize, in Daylongs, I've spent a lot of time, and I'll just say it briefly here. There's not so much time tonight, so I didn't do it. More or less, the Buddhist path is really emphasizing waking up from the dream completely. Just completely waking up from the dream, which we would call enlightenment. Yeah, we would call that enlightenment. But on a relative level, in order to wake up from the dream, we also have to have some kind of functional or healthy dream relationship. Yeah. So this isn't necessarily in the traditional teachings, because often cultures, Indian culture and Tibetan culture, there was much more a communal base, and so much more a base for creating a healthy human being. Not completely, but in America, in the West, we often, a lot of us suffer from a lot of anxiety issues, feeling completely separate from there's a lack of community. Sometimes we grew up with dysfunctional situations where there was some abuse, things like that. So for some of us, we might have to work on just creating what my teacher calls a healthy dream. Yeah? And that creating the healthy dream will then help us actually. It's dreamlike, but we still heard it, right?
That's
and
right.
It still pissed us off, right? It pissed me off. So, anyways, so you know, one phrase my teacher Sonia Rinpoche says, you know, it's not functional to live in a nightmare all the time. You know, we don't want to live in a nightmare, so we need to. It's okay to create a positive dream, and I think when you move to Santa Cruz, you know. You know that. You're working with that. You know? Go to Verve Coffee, get a wonderful espresso. You know, I just got like a $6 chocolate bar. Go get a massage. Go do some Tai Chi. Go hang out at the beach. And I'm not dissing any of that. That's wonderful. You know, we're actually really fortunate, right, to be able to have access to those things. But if we remain stuck in that, we are still stuck in suffering. You see? So, but it's okay if you could go to the other extreme and say, well, screw it all, you know, and that's kind of an extreme too. So we have to live within we have to create a positive dream for ourselves, and then have the motivation also to completely wake up from the dream, okay? So I'm not going so much into how to create a positive dream today, because I've done that in Daylongs, and we just don't have a lot of time tonight. So an example that's very common when we're talking about waking up from this dream state is a metaphor I really like, where I need one of those like movie voices, you know, on a dark, you know, those like really deep. I don't have the real one, you know. But anyways,
you could find it.
So on a dark night, on a dusty road in Bodh Gaya, in India. Yeah. This is the metaphor. We're walking on this dusty road. Yeah. In as the sun's going down, and in the road is something coiled. Yeah. And because of the condition of the darkness, and also because of our own habit, we first have a type of ignorance where we don't know what it is, and we have a choice. Yeah, our habit kind of comes into effect here, and then it's quite easy to label that rope as a snake. Yeah, I didn't say that. So what's in the what's in the middle of the road is a rope. Yeah, it's coiled. Yeah. Sorry, I forgot that part. That's pretty important, right? So there's a coiled rope there. But because of the darkness, we mistake it as a snake. And then once we mistake it as a snake, we actually believe it's a snake. And then because of that, we have all kinds of reactions to that. Oh, I love snakes. I want to, I hate, well, for most people, I hate snakes, and then you run or you try to avoid it or whatever, or you scream. Some people might think, well, I love snakes, and they might try to go put it in their house in a glass case, whatever. Someone might try to marry that. There's all kinds of things in our world, right? So I heard some woman she married a dog. There's something on Facebook about that. I don't know if I believe things on Facebook. I was just telling the other group. I taught this same teaching on Tuesday night in Oakland, and that there's. I really, when I say a quote of the Buddha now, I really have to check it out, because there's a lot of fake Buddha quotes, on the internet. And not like I get all of them from the internet, but I do. I'm not going to lie. I see them. Usually people post the most inspiring ones too, yeah. But anyways, there's a whole website called Fake Buddha Quotes, yeah? Are you the one who told me that? I don't know. I found it somehow. Mm-hmm. And anyways, I don't know why I just thought of that, but... So this metaphor is talking about more or less our entire experience. Again, our reference point, where because of, you could say, delusion or because of habit, yeah, we're constantly mistaking a rope for a snake. Yeah? So here, there's appearance. And so again, I'm just emphasizing, the appearance isn't the problem. Yeah. So there's appearance. That's not the problem. It's believing it's true that's a problem. That's what the Buddha was saying. Believing that is the problem. So first we have to start. We're not going to be able to see the rope right away as a beginner. I consider myself a beginner too. So as a beginner, we're not going to be able to see that rope. What we have to do is first question: is that a snake? And then we go through this process of shedding away that it's a snake until we finally come to the direct experience, which is the rope. Yeah. So. This word truth, I told you I defined it before. So if we say real but not true, so I'm getting back to sort of the title of the talk tonight. If we say real, it's kind of funny to say real in Buddhism, but I just sort of use that because it's a phrase Sonya Rinpoche said, and it's kind of catchy, right? So anyways, you can't really say real, but let's just say it here. So real in the sense of it appears. Things, phenomena continue to appear, they continue to function, yeah? But not true in the sense that they're actually a rope. But what the Buddha was saying is the suffering is every moment when we take birth, we're seeing the rope as a snake. And this is a moment by moment. And in Buddhism, we break down the moment into, I forget, there's like 100 to 200 moments within a snap. Those are called a moment. So we're taking each one, we're taking birth into seeing this rope as a snake. You see what I'm saying? And by seeing it as a snake, I can mean anything. It doesn't have to be some big explosion, like some big anger or some big, like, something like that. Literally, just sitting here, I'm taking birth because I'm perceiving it as some kind of true or unchanging entity on a very deep level, not necessarily intellectually. But how do we work with this? We have to first start on an intellectual level, having an understanding, and then shedding it, yeah? So this definition of truth. So real things continue to appear, but they're not true. Why? Because if something is true, from a Buddhist perspective, it has to be permanent and unchanging. That's what we call something true. So then, we don't have time tonight so much, but I really, implore you, please try to find something that's true. Like, really investigate, maybe we have some time, it's only 8:15, maybe we'll take a few minutes here. just reflect. So here we're going to gently use our analysis, yeah? You can think about your anything, your work, your children, like your spouse, your body, the ocean, the sidewalk, chocolate, Orange is the New Black, whatever, you know? So just bring the phenomenon into your mind and think, is this true? Meaning, is it unchanging and independent? It's pretty hard to do this, but I want you to do it. You can just start with one if you want. If you just want to use unchanging, that's fine. Or if you want to use independent, that's fine. So maybe we're going to use our hand in a second as an example, so maybe I'll just slim it down for us. Just use your hand. Could be your left or right hand. So just investigate. Is my hand unchanging? So has it, meaning, has it stayed the same forever? Mm-hmm. You could say that too, yeah. So right away we know, duh, right? You're like, nam so duh, yeah, of course not, right? But still, that's not the point. The investigation is the point. So just think about it. Is my hand unchanging? And then try to come up with as many reasonings as you can. Then is my hand independent? Meaning, is it on its own, not depending on anything else? I'll give you some clues, but I don't want to write them. I just want you to think, yeah? So again, we it's not independent, correct? Actually, I want to hear from some of you. So, some reasons why it's not unchanging or independent, yeah?
It's attached to the arm.
Yeah.
It was born much smaller and smoother.
Yeah. So that's the independent and unchanging part, yeah. Yeah, good.
Oh, it's also got fingers, which are, you know, it can go down to smaller parts. You can't say it's this kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You took my teaching. So. I'm not going to say that. That's good. I mean, yeah, some of it's obvious, right?
Sensations are changing.
Yeah.
Moment by moment. Mm-hmm.
Good. Anyone else?
Dependent on the circulation of blood. Yeah. It's dependent on the nervous system.
Yeah.
For movement. For being dependent.
Yeah.
Nourishment, food, sun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Water.
Good. Also, it's dependent on our mind. Yeah. Perceiving it. We're perceiving it as a hand. It's also good. I mean, we can go more mm-hmm. subtle like that. So maybe just take a second, we'll just take a minute. So any of those reasons that people said, or if you came up with your own, now just drop the investigation and just rest, okay? So what I mean by rest is you're just resting with that experience of the hand being a changeable phenomenon and also dependent. It's not independent. So just rest with that. That feeling. Did it, and we didn't do it enough, but it might have. Did it create some space? Yeah? Meaning space between how you're perceiving your hand or your reference point to your hand. So investigate that. If it didn't, maybe investigate more. And then when you've come to a place of it's creating some kind of space, just rest there. By rest, I mean don't do anything. Just rest on that feeling of feeling the space or that thought or experience. So generally, there's these three mistakes when we're looking at our hand. Or you could take any of the aggregates, yeah? But we're taking the hand part of the form aggregate. So first, we can make the mistake of thinking the hand is the same as yesterday's hand. Yeah? So this would be sort of ascribing some kind of permanence to it, yeah? So this is a mistake of ascribing permanence. Then we could look at the hand as a whole and not made up of parts. So this is sort of ascribing some kind of singularity to the hand, yeah? And then we can think of our hand as independent, or it's not dependent upon parts. So these are, in Buddhist scripture, this we call, you guys kind of figured those out more or less. Some of you came to those conclusions. So you could see how this isn't deep. Again, we're coming to this conclusion because they're actual reality. But what I want you to notice is how often do we think like that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a monk and I don't think like that very often, you know. I'm supposed to. But it's, you know, we get stuck in our habits, so it's hard to think like that. So again, I'm just giving you a taste of sort of, this is what we do with an analytical meditation, yeah? We investigate like that. And you can investigate everything. You can investigate form, yeah, the form aggregate, the feeling aggregate, and so forth, yeah? Discrimination. You can investigate each one and work with it that way, yeah? Okay, so now let's do some practice. And then I want to leave enough time for questions and stuff. Is it too much? It's okay? Yeah? It's clear? Okay. So this, I didn't want to do too much analytical meditation because I mostly want to focus on this one. So when we say the word vipassana, when we break it out in the Tibetan tradition, obviously we mean insight or insight meditation, but whenever we're talking about vipassana, we're talking about something, a type of practice or meditation that is really trying to understand or experience the nature of the thing, the phenomena, the I, whatever, the nature, yeah? Then we have shamatha, right, where we're focusing directly on some kind of phenomena. Shamatha doesn't necessarily mean you're understanding the nature. It can help you move in that direction. But really the vipassana practice is where we're really working with this aspect of either what we just did when we did that investigation, that's also a type of vipassana practice. It's just more of an analytical or logic-oriented vipassana. So now we're going to do a vipassana practice that's a little bit more direct and not so analytical. Okay? So I'm going to guide it a little bit, and then we'll just practice silently. So here we kind of, in the last meditation, even though it was quite short, when we were analytically checking the hand for any kind of permanence or independence or singularity, here we're not trying to bring about emptiness or any kind of experience of how something truly exists. Here we're just sitting and watching the skandhas. So I think the easiest, but you can choose if you want, but for most of you, I think the easiest is just work with the form. So just observe your form. So here we're not like a fisherman trying to catch some rare fish. We're just observing, we're just watching. So first just be aware of your aggregate, the form. Be aware that you have a body. Just notice you have a body. And just sit and watch. There's no focal point. We're just watching the experience unfold of the body, of the form. It's quite simple, but not easy in practice. Just gently watch your form, being aware of form. Watching here does not necessarily mean involving. We're not getting involved in any kind of analyzing or judging. We're simply just observing. If your attention wanders, just bring it back to watching. And again, there's an open quality to this. If you're fixating too much, just drop your fixation. Rest openly, unobstructedly, without any kind of agenda, without any goal. Rest like a small child who looks at a painting for the first time. There's a quality of awe or curiosity. There's a quality of openness and watching. Just letting be in that watching. Normally we're involving all the time, tying ourselves in knots with involvement. A reference point appears to us in our experience in that moment throughout the day, and through fixating we tie ourselves in knots with that reference point. So here, if a reference point comes, just watch it. Don't involve. Just be with that. Here we're giving our involving a rest. When we just look and we observe, the stickiness or glue of our experience starts to loosen. We slowly start to gain freedom from being manipulated by our reference point. For a reference point, he or she also wants freedom, so we don't completely squash the reference point. Just watch and be with that. Here we're pulling the rug out from under our concept or reference point or illusion. But we're actually not pulling out anything, because there was nothing on the rug, there's nothing pulling the rug, and there was no rug to begin with. There's nothing we're really doing here. Just let be aware. let experience unfold naturally, but with no involvement, just watching. The quality of gently resting here. If you're feeling tight, it's probably because you're trying to fish for something. So don't fish for anything. Just let go, but be aware. Relax your body. If other phenomena are arising, like feelings, be they sensations or emotions, you can also just watch them, be with them, that's fine. Or you can continue with form. If thoughts are continually arising, just watch the thoughts. Don't get involved, don't judge the thoughts, just watch. Or if you're bored, just watch being bored. If you're tired or sleepy, just watch that. Whatever comes into your experience, just be with that. If you're scattered or losing focus, that's fine, just watch that. Again, there's no sort of right answer or agenda here. Slowly we're just creating space between our experience and our reference point. Don't expect the reference point to disappear either. It's going to be with us for a long time. Maybe. Just work with the space in between the watcher and the reference point. If you have pain in your body, watch that. Be with that. Let go into that. just simply be with your experience. When we constantly involve with our experience, it's like glue or honey. When we just watch, we're not detaching from our experience. We're just making a choice to create some space and slowly loosen that glue. Or stickiness. Who cares? I mean, I care, but you should say that to yourself. Good or bad, who cares? Doesn't matter. So we got about 20 minutes, so we got plenty of time for questions if people have any comments or complaints. Suspend what?
When you get rid of your reference point.
For me,
the use of positive mental and emotional states as a method is tipping the balance point, but at the same time, it's not suspending.
No, that's a really good question, actually. I didn't say this, but I'll say it now. So, you know, within the path of Buddha Dharma, or these 84,000 teachings, really you can put them into two categories, more or less, when we're just talking in language, because we have to do that, right, when we're talking the path. So then you have method aspects of the path, and then wisdom aspects. And wisdom is what we've just worked with wisdom, more or less, yeah? And then you have the method aspects, which is loving kindness, working with compassion, and also any kind of doing thing, the paramitas. These are all method aspects. But eventually, as we practice method and wisdom, we do them both. They actually start to unify. And then what happens is what is the goal, which is the sort of unification of method and wisdom. And one way to think of it is that method and wisdom were never ever separate. So this is the main answer I'm going to give to you. method and wisdom, they're never ever separate. It's not like you can't separate emptiness from compassion. You can't actually do that. But we do that. Why? Because we live in a dualistic framework. Our reference point is a dualistic. Just by having a reference point, already we have subject and object. So therefore we have me, us or me, and other. You see? So when that reference point gets shed more and more and more, what eventually drops for someone after a lot of practice is this aspect on relating to method is of a me and an other. And then what comes out is the sort of you could say expression or the natural radiance of emptiness is compassion and loving kindness. So what we say from a Buddhist perspective, and this is definitely more like maybe more of a Vajrayana view, but I'll say it here, is that the inherent within the qualities of the nature of reality is the expression naturally of compassion. So when someone becomes an enlightened being, naturally they attain what's called the three bodies. So one is the Dharma body, which is basically their realization of emptiness. Then the other two are the form bodies. Now these form bodies are what actually benefit others. So simultaneously one attains the knowing of reality and the being in the actual nature of reality completely referenceless. And at that same time, from that non-referential point, they ceaselessly manifest to benefit others. So it's a little bit of a... is it too out there, the answer? It's a little bit esoteric, but that's the only way I know how to say ultimately when we're unifying them, it gets to this point. But on a relative level, like relating to just us on the path, you have to do both. You have to practice, slowly work with emptiness to shed away the reference point and come to a very natural way of viewing our experience, yeah? And then at the same time, you're going to also build up what we call like virtuous habits, yeah? Or constructive habits of loving kindness, compassion, all of those good things, being generous, yeah, being patient. Those actually, believe it, what's so interesting with this is like those actually help to then shed the reference point. So they're all like steps on a ladder. You see? So it's like, again, you actually have a lot of different means or methods within Buddhism to shed this reference point. One is like primarily meditating on emptiness, like we were talking about tonight. One is devotion, like through extremely strong devotional practice. The yogi or yogini's reference point will shed, and one is through bodhicitta or the loving kindness and compassion practices aimed at enlightenment. Through those practices, one can also shed. I think you can see this in the life of saints, like with their devotion, they almost become like. Again, when we lose our reference point, it doesn't mean we become like dull or. I'm not saying you're saying this. I'm just adding on because it makes me think of this. It doesn't mean we become like nothing. There's still something. There's still appearance. There's still something that functions, more or less. But then the reference point is this fixated aspect of being fixated on some sense of a self and some sense of an other. And therefore, you can really serve others. So what's really interesting in the world, I find, is we're always trying to fix things, you know? And one teacher, I think it's Polnam Rinpoche, he has this really nice way of saying it. It's like, we're always fixing, like, the house can, like, you're in a house where the foundation is cracked. The house might continue to have problems and move this way and that way, and cracks are going to happen in the roofs and the windows and all kinds of things. And the person who owns the house doesn't know the foundation is cracked. So they're continually fixing windows and walls and ceilings and all sorts of stuff, right? But they never go and think, well, there's something wrong with the foundation itself. So as a Buddhist practitioner, there's nothing wrong with trying to help the world. We have to do that. That's part of our, like, responsibility is to benefit others as much as we can. But if we're doing that thinking we're going to fix something, there's a little bit of a problem from a Buddhist perspective, you see? Because there's still a reference point. Mm-hmm. So we can never actually completely benefit others. It's really a tricky thing. Mm-hmm. Is that make any sense? Sort of, yeah. It's a lot, sorry. It just opened up a little bit of can of worms. It's a really good question, actually. But just on a basic level, we have to do both. I'll just say that, because that's maybe more what you're asking, right? We have to practice both.
Yeah, I think some of us are drawn in one direction, mm-hmm. and some of us are drawn in the other, and Yeah, it's like you have to detach from the idea that you're doing good. You're
doing. Well, who's doing the good? That's what we're asking. And who's the beneficiary of that? Mm-hmm. You know, and then what like you could say kind of like the ultimate doing good is non-doing. I mean, that's really kind of esoteric, but it's true. You know? But again, that's an experience we have to come to slowly. So then in order to do that, we have to use all the methods within Buddhism and then all the practices of wisdom. We should try to engage as many that we feel comfortable with, because they're going to benefit us as long as we're actually practicing them. Yeah. Really good. Yeah.
Playing off on what she said, I've noticed in my own practice, the dichotomy that you have with the wisdom versus compassion, and going heavy into the wisdom thing, and suddenly the ego's taken over, I don't even see it. And I hit this like wall, you know? And then you try the compassion part of it, and it just kind of dissolves this doing thing. It seems like, for me, it's like you go vacillate between the two, and you can't really get too much deeper unless you somehow use both.
Yeah, no, that's right on. Yeah, you have to. I mean, just as beginners, like that's what I do as a beginner. I every day I do both. Like, I'll meditate some on more relative bodhicitta practices of like the four immeasurables, like what we chanted earlier. Mm-hmm. I might meditate with that and try to feel that and bring it into my day as well. And then I might do some practice like an emptiness practice, like what we did. And for us, they're not unified, right? Mm-hmm. But as we practice more and more, what I'm saying is they'll unify more and more until they become inseparable. And the inseparability is really enlightenment. When we say the full inseparability of method or compassion and wisdom is enlightenment. But what's so interesting and what I wanted to point out is they were never separate. Mm-hmm. They're not separate. But we have this illusion that they are. And the illusion is so ingrained, and it's such an ingrained habit or reference point, using the language I've used throughout the night. It's so hard to break that, and that's why we need to work on it. It's just like anything else. If, you know, I have a habit not to be an amazing jazz pianist, you know? But if I work on that, and if I practice every day, I may be, you see? So we have to practice, too. But yeah, thank you for emphasizing that. Yeah, you need both. Anybody else? Yeah.
I really appreciate what you said about the habit of we go about our daily life, but we're going from one place to another, or we're going home, and we assume it's going to be the same thing.
Yeah.
But really, I had no idea this was going to happen, this moment was going to happen at all, or in any way that it did. And there's no way to assume that as the days and maybe practice sessions ensue, that we know what will come about.
Yeah. It's a really important observation, no? I mean, it can kind of open our whole mood, yeah? I mean, I don't know about you, some of you, but when I get into, like, a stuck point, like, when it's, from this perspective, from what I've been talking about, we're, unfortunately, it's saying we're always stuck, but then I think what can happen is that we can get super stuck, like, you know, like, you're, I don't know how to say it another way, but, you know, really stuck in, like, a mood, like, you know, being bummed out or, you know, something we don't like. You know, and what can really be useful is just to really reflect on that. Oh, this is, well, it's a changing phenomenon, first of all. It will change. That's a pretty simple way. But at the same time, it's almost like, oh, this is totally, like, open. The reason it's being fixated in a one-dimensional way is because I'm relating to it like that. But again, it's a slow process. The habit has to be shed slowly. It's not like we're going to go from A to Z at once. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah.
This teaching, real but not true, reminds me of something I heard. A Dharma, or a talk by Alan Watts. When he was referencing in the East, I don't know which particular religion it is, but they were talking about how they see the world as, or reality, as a play. And that to whatever degree you believe in the play is how, you know, how much dust you have in your eye. I mean, for example, I mean, if you go to a play, there's Hamlet up on stage, but it's not Hamlet, that's some guy I went to high school with. You know? So the levels of reality, I mean, you can be moved by something that's not even real.
No, that's actually, thank you for saying that.
Or truth, certainly.
Yeah, yeah, I was trying to point that out earlier, but I said it very briefly. Because we're not denying appearance here, we're not denying that experience can happen. So it's not a nihilism when we're talking about emptiness. There's not a nothingness. Exactly that. Actually, as you see it as a, we could use that analogy, as you see it as a play, and as it sort of, you see it as like some grand play, it actually enriches our experience. Yeah, it's quite amazing.
Yeah, it takes you, it keeps you from believing all the time and getting trapped in the cycle of birth.
Yeah, no, that's really good. It's sort of, there was one thing I want to say, but I forgot. Things can function like that. Like, they'll continue to play out however they do. And if we choose to be stuck in a certain habit of relating that, or we choose to view it more with awe, is a way to say it, in a kind of awe and appreciation. But that appreciation also doesn't have a reference point. So again, it's easy. What's so tricky about this is, like, we get on. It's easy to get stuck in something else, like a spiritual approach, per se, right? Like from that approach. Is it a Zen saying, like, well, if you see a Buddha on the road, kill him? Something like that. It's very much relating to this, you know. Again, just cut everything. So that's one way. But the play can still happen, and there can still be a relationship with that. There will be. I mean, there's no choice. Really good, yeah.
This concept of shedding your reference point, before I say this, it's just a coincidence, by the way, I don't have any children, but is this a nature that children have, to shed their reference point?
You mean like they naturally already don't have much of a reference point?
Correct.
So I think so, because usually just when we come in, automatically into this, like a new body, we could say it that way. The habits of like being a human being are sort of not so concrete. Of course, from a Buddhist perspective, that person's probably had many lives, that child as a human, but still the habits from this life haven't come in yet, so there's less reference point. There's still the deep reference point of an I or a me or a self. They see even like an ant has that kind of reference. I'm not saying like if you ask them, where's you, they're going to be able to point that out. Or say I, or something like that. It's saying, from a Buddhist perspective, the deepest kind of ignorance is just this very instinctual kind of I or self. And that's what, again, we shed the layers, and that's one of the last layers that gets shed. But, it's true, they have less of a reference point. It's not completely gone, but they have less of one. It's kind of like when you see some great, I don't know, has anybody met some really, really profound masters in their life? I'm sure a lot of you have. I mean, when you meet a great, great yogi or yogini, sometimes you can, they're a little childlike sometimes, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe not all the time, maybe, but maybe but some of the time at least. Mm-hmm. I call it like, I had this kind of aspiration, I was joking with my friend, like I'd like to be a baby with wisdom. Because babies kind of have this kind of awe, but then of course they, you know, we need the wisdom aspect. By wisdom I mean the emptiness aspect too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
Baby
with wisdom.
I'm just feeling how the experience of retreats is so valuable in that reference point, because then things are fresh for maybe a day. Well, hopefully more than that.
Depends on the length of the retreat, and then. I always have like my countdown watch. Like I did a 100-day retreat this last winter. I'm like, okay, 2 weeks I probably got, maybe a week.
And then it's like this experience of you're relating to someone that you're used to relating to, and suddenly it's completely new and different and spontaneous and light.
It's really an advantage doing retreat. Benefit of doing retreat.
How come it doesn't last?
Well, again, that kind of becomes, unfortunately, that becomes like a new reference point for us.
Okay.
So it's really interesting, you know. When this, that's why this is so, like, I don't know, you know. That's why when the Buddha became enlightened, you know, he sat under the Bodhi tree for a while and thought, nobody's going to understand this. I don't think he was thinking that. Because, you know, there's some experience where you ah, no one's going to get this. And he had to be entreated to teach, right?
Yeah.
So then, I think that was one of the reasons, because it's like, the habit's so strong. But it doesn't mean we have to try. We have to work. Does anybody have any kind of comments? I'm curious what just the last meditation we did, if what kind of experience you had from that? Doesn't have to be just maybe a short answer, or doesn't have to be profound, just sort of thinking. Good.
Spacious.
Yeah.
The psychedelic.
what did you take with Brady? You never know in Santa Cruz, you know. I never know what to expect. Yeah.
I felt that I had a very hard time finding any space.
But were you trying to find a space?
I was very, I felt very grounded and mm-hmm. very solid. And it was hard for me to move out of that solid space.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
I have more of a sense of my body changing as I watch. Not which I hadn't ever had before.
Oh.
Sitting here on the screen. Whoa.
That's good news. Keep going. Keep doing that. Yeah. But one comment I had about this, this is practice so simple, yeah. It's so subtle, but it's actually, if you do it quite a bit, it's actually quite profound. It's quite transformative, I found. That's why I wanted to present it tonight. I mean, it's common to a lot of other Vipassana practices, and actually, really, one teacher, Tibetan teacher, who actually teaches this kind of way of meditating, he says you could actually bring this practice into all kinds of different vehicles within Buddhism. So you could practice like a more Vajrayana style of this. You could do a more Theravada style of this. You can do a Mahayana style of this. And it's not like anyone is better. It's just this practice is quite profound. It really crosses over a lot of Buddhism. That's what I think his point is. Yeah.
Just to kind of review, we were practicing with form.
Yeah.
And just experiencing what was.
Yes.
With form, and then resting in that experience, and use some words that were really it wasn't observing, it was
watching.
Watching.
Used the word watching.
Yeah. In this kind of style, you're just watching. Then sometimes, like more advanced practice, you'll actually watch for the watcher too. That's when it gets really interesting. Mm-hmm. But I didn't introduce that tonight because we're just working with the aggregates more or less. Yeah.
That term watching. Sometimes I wonder about using that word because, to me, watching has something to do with seeing.
Yeah.
And what I like better is sensing.
Mm-hmm.
I like to sense. When I'm working with form, I like to sense.
Yeah.
Just and then when I sense, my experience is constant change, constant mm-hmm. tingling and vibrations and heat changes and then that sort of loosens that sense that I'm this solid piece of form, but rather just a changing bunch of changing sensations.
That's good. I think whatever, like, language is so dualistic, so it's, yeah. it's by watching. I actually meant that too.
I assume that you did. Yeah.
I think it's good to play with words, and we'll have to find what works for us, right? Because the English, when you bring the English language into Dharma, it gets very interesting. You know, I could say one word and have 20 different. Yeah. No, that's good though. Observing. Yeah, observing. Not involving. I like letting be
alone.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah, that was good. Yeah. That's a good term.
That's the one you were letting
go. Yeah, I like that too.
Yeah, so whatever works for you, you know. The whole point is there's some way of being with our experience that starts to unglue the stickiness that we're normally involved in. Yeah? That's the whole point of that.
Right. Yeah.
I think we'll stop. Any more? Otherwise I'm going to stop. Yeah. So we'll just dedicate on the last page here. So each one will say in Tibetan once and once in English. Sanan Vietam Chesin Vani Kong
By this merit may we obtain our positions, having defeated the enemy's negativities. May we liberate all beings from the ocean of existence, with its stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. May the precious Bodhicitta arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen may it not decay, but increase further and further. May the precious view of emptiness arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen may it not decay, but increase further and further.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Have a great evening.
Thank you.
Good, what do you call it? Not
good to see you.
Hi, Bruce.
Oh, you're going to go to the Wonder Woman.
Yeah, but I have been.
Okay, that's a
huge time.
Inspiration. Say hi to Alan.
But no. Yeah, that's yeah.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.